Walter Isaacson is a biographer of geniuses like Benjamin Franklin, and in his new book, he reveals the origins of the most genius revolutionary line in the Declaration of Independence. He does so in his book, The Greatest Sentence Ever Written. To celebrate America's 250th anniversary, Isaacson takes readers on a deep dive into the creation of one of history's most powerful sentences. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Drafted by Thomas Jefferson, edited by Benjamin Franklin and John Adams, this line lays the foundation for the American dream and defines the common ground we share as a nation. It is a great pleasure to welcome back to this program Walter Isaacson. Thank you very much for being with us. Always a pleasure to have you.
It's wonderful to be back. Thank you for having me.
What brought you to this particular sentence? I mean, obviously, there is the anniversary, but what brought you to these words?
You know, we've become very polarized as a nation, tearing ourselves apart with our poisonous politics. And there are certain values that we pretty much all share in common. And so for the 250th, I thought it would be good to just look at the mission statement, the aspirational statement that founded our nation, so that we could maybe rally around it, the concepts, but also that sentence went through four or five drafts. And I wanted to look at the edits to see what Jefferson, Franklin, and Adams meant by each word, because sometimes we just chant along with that sentence like it's a prayer in church without pausing to say, what do they mean by we? What do they mean by self-evident? What do they mean by created equal?
And of course, this all happens as they are bringing to us a new nation, a new type of nation, which is why those words were so important.
You know, 47 years after they were written, the phrase you just used was used by Abraham Lincoln to consecrate the battlefield at Gettysburg, in which he said they were bringing forth a new type of nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. And I write about innovation. Those are the biographies I do, whether it's Steve Jobs or Elon Musk or Leonardo da Vinci or Jennifer Doudna. But one of the great innovations of human history was this notion of a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
As you mentioned, I mean, the first word is we. The first word in the Constitution is we the people. What, and you look at this at the beginning of the book, why is we so important?
It used to be, before the United States came into being, that power of governments came either from the sword of conquerors or the divine right of kings. And what they were doing was creating a type of democratic republic based on what's called social contract theory. That's what John Locke wrote about in his second treatise on government that Thomas Jefferson loved so much. And the contract theory says the power of the government derives from a social contract made by the people who enter into that society. And so I think the word we is an important word. It's not just about 59 guys in Philadelphia that summer. It's about a social contract that makes sure that our rights come from the consent of the governed.
So it is Jefferson who is invoking this collective will with that beginning sentence, we hold these truths.
Absolutely. And of course, when they open the Constitution with we the people, they're invoking this collective will, this notion of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was the age of science in the 1700s, in which the notions of science, checks and balances and equilibrium, were applied to government. And the three main writers of the Declaration, Jefferson, Franklin, and Adams, were all leaders of this Enlightenment way of thinking. And I hope we can get back to that, because they understood that sometimes you needed to have balance, that it wasn't all or nothing. And nowadays, we tend to be in an all-or-nothing political debate.
You make the point very early in the book, at the beginning of the book, we hold these truths to be sacred, that is, revised. What does that tell us, that that word was eventually replaced, sacred?
Yeah, Jefferson in his first draft, right, we hold these truths to be sacred. And Franklin takes out the pen he uses, a printer, because he owned a print shop when he was young, and does those backslashes that printers use when they edit things, and he crosses out sacred and he writes in self-evident. And his point was we were trying to create a new type of nation in which our rights come from rationality, not from the dictates or dogma of a religion. But the sentence goes on to invoke the Creator, because Jefferson had written that from their equal creation, they derive rights. And John Adams crosses that out and says they're endowed by their Creator with rights. And so you can see in the editing of a half a sentence, our founders balancing the role of divine providence and the role of rationality in giving us our rights, instead of saying it all comes because we're a Christian nation or it all comes from pure rationality. They say it's a balance.
Crafted by Thomas Jefferson, edited by Benjamin Franklin and John Adams, that sentence, give us a sense of the page that these three men were on. Were they mostly, it seems as if they're mostly in understanding and an agreement of changes that go forth in the sentence and in the document.
Yeah, they got along very well, especially Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin. Adams was a little bit of an outlier at times. But what they all agree on is the need to have a mission statement that can grow, that's aspirational. Jefferson took one of the phrases John Locke used, which is life, liberty, and property, and made it life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Because the drafters wanted this to be a document that could grow with each new generation, including generations that they knew would not tolerate things like slavery. They made it into a forcing mechanism, a mission statement, even though they knew they hadn't quite lived up to that statement.
When it comes to the truths, by labeling them self-evident, you point this out, not entirely correct, of course.
Well, right. Sometimes we think the word self-evident simply means obvious, you know, like, well, that's self-evident. I think they were using it, I know they were, in a more technical, philosophical sense, because Ben Franklin had just spent a month or so living with David Hume, the greatest English language philosopher of that period, who had come up with notions of self-evident truths that are true not based on looking at different facts, but they're true based on reason. Like all bachelors are unmarried. You don't have to go around asking bachelors, do you have a wife? It's just fundamentally self-evident because it's part of the definition. That's what they meant by created equal. Because if you look around, of course, we're not all equal. Some are taller and shorter and smarter or handsomer, or whatever it may be. But what they're saying is because we all came together to form a society in a social contract, we are all equal under that social contract.
Walter Isaacson is our guest. The new book is The Greatest Sentence Ever Written. It is out from Simon and Schuster. You write about all men, and this is, of course, in that second line, that all men are created equal. And the question that is asked so often, and you, of course, look at it in the book, is did the founders mean the word men to refer to all humankind or to men?
Well, you know, the word men has been used ever since Plato to refer to humankind, you know, the rights of man. But actually, unfortunately, in the Continental Congress, they did discuss whether women should have the same rights. Abigail Adams famously writes to her husband John remember the ladies, make sure you give them rights. And John Adams says, no, you know, I cannot but laugh. We're not going to give up our masculine prerogatives. And so even though they meant that phrase sounds expansive, they actually did not give women rights at the founding. However, that sentence becomes a forcing mechanism so that more than 150 years later, when the women's suffragette movement is taking hold, they use that sentence in their founding documents to say we have to expand it so that all have certain rights in this country.
And you note that it was never debated.
Right. They never said, okay, let's see whether women should have the same property rights as men. And it was true both in England and in France and other places at the time that there was an unequal status of men and women. And our founders were brilliant, but they were not too far ahead of their time. Fortunately, they gave us a sentence that we can all look at as aspirational. We can say, how do we make what they wanted even more true than they made it? And that includes, in the arc of American history, including more and more people into that notion that were created equal and endowed with inalienable rights like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
All men are created equal, and obviously people differ in their talents and their abilities, as you note in the book. And they wanted that to be known, right? That if one individual compared to another individual, no matter what they're doing, that they are indeed equal.
They wanted to make sure that we were equal in terms of the rights we had as citizens of this new nation, that everybody was entitled to the rights of liberty and to the rights of life in the pursuit of happiness. And that was what they were aiming for, not a literal interpretation that we're all the exact same.
We talk about this, of these important words, because we're starting a new nation. But they are also showing, it seems, that they wanted a fundamental change to the British system, that they wanted that to be obvious.
Yes. I mean, the whole purpose of the Declaration is to declare why we're overthrowing the monarchy. And most of the Declaration is made up of charges against the king for, you know, violating the rights of Americans and, allowing troops to be stationed in our homes and forbidding immigration into our borders. And so they're writing this to describe, as they put it in the first sentence, with a decent respect to the opinions of mankind, why we're overthrowing a monarchy and trying to create a new type of nation that's based on a social contract where we decide by the consent of the governed that we're going to give everybody equal rights.
You write, Jefferson didn't use this dodge. He simply wrote, all men are created equal and independent. And then, making it even punchier, he declared an independent. Talk a little bit about, as you say, all men are created equal, free, and independent, and have certain inherent natural rights. This obviously brings in slavery and the discussion. Talk about the three men and their thoughts on this issue and how it was eventually worked out.
It's a great contradiction, a great conflict, in some ways a great sin that's part of our founding, is that Jefferson can write this draft and say all men are created equal. And with him in that room, besides John Adams and Ben Franklin, there's a 19-year-old named Robert Hemings, who is Jefferson's enslaved valet, who's come up with him from Monticello, whose younger sister Sally will become the mother of Jefferson's children, yet remain enslaved the rest of her life. And that is this contradiction that even Jefferson understood, because he writes words that decry slavery later on in the Declaration, and yet he doesn't free his slaves. And so, as I said earlier, 67 years after that sentence is written, Abraham Lincoln invokes it as he's burying 7,058 people at the Battle of Gettysburg Cemetery who fought to make that sentence more true. So what you have is a sentence that's not necessarily true in 1776, but it gives us our mission. It says, here's our aspiration. And then it's up to each new generation to make it more true. And it took until, you know, 67 years before we fought to end slavery. It took longer than that before we included women into it. And even Dr. King, as he's pushing the civil rights movements, invokes this greatest sentence ever written to push the nation to live up to the ideals that the founders gave us, even if they didn't fully live up to the ideals. It's a great arc of American history that we have to celebrate, but know that we were overcoming many difficulties as the arc of history bent towards justice.
The line that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. These three men, as you point out, Franklin, Adams, and Jefferson, they had different views of what creator meant, right? I mean, it was looked at differently in their own personal lives.
Right. Sometimes people try to capture the founders and say it was a Christian nation with Christian nationalism. Not exactly true. All three of the people we talked about, Jefferson, Franklin, Adams, were deists. And deist was a creed or a way of belief at that time of the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, that believed there was a creator, but that the creator was somewhat mysterious. And they did not necessarily believe in a God who would intervene in our affairs, who would make miracles happen. In fact, Jefferson has a famous Bible at Monticello where he took a razor blade and cut out all the mentions of the miracles of Jesus and just left Jesus's moral teachings. What they gave us because of that outlook was a system of tolerance, indeed a system of respect, where in Philadelphia at that time, there were people of all different creeds. There were Quakers and Anglicans and Jews and Moravians and slaves and freed slaves and Baptists. And they said, we're going to create the type of nation in which whatever type of beliefs you have, even if they're not conventional Christian beliefs, all are going to be not only tolerated, but respected.
You write, the final version of the Declaration of Independence declares that people are endowed with certain unalienable rights. That's not exactly how Jefferson wrote it. He used the word inalienable, which is how the phrase is inscribed in the Jefferson Memorial. But Adams, when he made a copy of Jefferson's rough draft, changed it to unalienable, and that is the way it appeared in the parchment approved on July 4th. Tell us about the differences of those and that slight change.
Well, actually, there's not that much of a difference. I tried to parse every word in that sentence because I want us to understand the depth and the profundity of that sentence. And I spent a long time trying to figure out, is there a difference between inalienable and unalienable? And I think it was mainly a transcribing change that John Adams made. I kind of like it the way Jefferson had it. At first, I like the word inalienable. It sounds better. But sometimes you have to realize, well, there's not any real difference.
and probably thinking, oh, well, will we still be, you know, this guiding us 250 years later? And obviously the answer is yes. But what does it mean? What does unalienable mean?
It means that the rights cannot be taken away from you. You can give up certain rights when you enter a state of nature. In other words, when we're in the state of nature, which is what they talked about during the Enlightenment of being before we had governments and there was anarchy, you know, you could take any property, you could grab anything you wanted, Well, we give up those rights voluntarily, maybe to take other people's property or to run red lights, whatever it may be, when we enter into a state of government. But there are certain rights that we just don't give up. And we don't give up our rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These are not something that can be taken away from us, or that we can even say we're going to, for example, put ourselves into slavery because we don't want liberty.
When it comes to, and looking at all these words, obviously, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that those three of that life and liberty, and yes, the pursuit of happiness, of a general understanding that we the people will know what that means, that we know what that pursuit of happiness is.
Well, I think what it is trying to do, because Jefferson uses that phrase instead of the more specific phrases like the pursuit of property and the ownership of estates, he wants each new generation, and for that matter, every individual, to be able to define for itself or himself or herself, what is meaningful to me? Now, when he says pursuit of happiness, he doesn't just mean let's go to a party Saturday night. He means it the way Plato does, which is what is the good life? But maybe for us in the 21st century, what is the good life? What is the pursuit of happiness? Maybe somewhat different than it was 100, 200, 250 years ago. That's why this is a living sentence, allowing each generation and each person in each generation to say, I have the freedom, I have the liberty to pursue happiness in a way that best fulfills my desires.
You say as we reach the 250th anniversary of the Declaration, we are embroiled in increasingly polarized debates over policies ranging from healthcare and housing to immigration and the role of religion in our society. One way to restore stability to our politics is to look at issues through the two ideals that are at the heart of the Declaration's key sentence, common ground and the pursuit of the American dream. Why does that become so contentious?
Look, common ground is what this sentence and what the Declaration is all about. These are the values we share. And part of what was thought of as common ground was actually physical, which was people can own private property, but there are certain things we put in the commons. For example, if you own private property, but there'd be a commons where the commoners, that's where the word comes from, who don't own a lot of property, they got to graze their sheep. When I went to school in Boston, I saw Boston Common and Cambridge Common. I thought, hey, they're just nice parks. Then I realized those were the common grounds where people got to graze herds, tend their gardens, bury their dead. In the founding of our country, Franklin in particular figures out what else should be in the commons. Well, he starts a fire department, a police department. And then over the years, we decide education, elementary education, should be in the commons. In other words, everybody should have access to it. Franklin created the Academy for the Education of Youth in Philadelphia. We're still debating over things like that. For example, Franklin, discussed with his friends in Philadelphia, should health care be something we share in commons? And they said, partly. They create the Hospital Company of Philadelphia that's partly public and partly private, but they put health care in it. Nowadays, we shut down our government because we can't figure out how much do we balance what type of health care goes into the commons. And so I think maybe we could take some of the poison out of our debate by saying this is not all or nothing. It's not you're either a communist or you're a fascist, but you can be like Benjamin Franklin and our founders and say, yes, we got to figure out how much health care, how much police protection, how much fire protection, how much widows and orphan insurance should we share in commons versus have as private property?
John Hancock, with great flourish, signs the document and says we must all hang together. Benjamin Franklin replies that, yes, we must, indeed all hang together, or most assuredly we shall all hang separately. That's still true today, isn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, what John Hancock was saying is that there are a lot of forces contending to divide us. That's what he says in that speech. And he says, with all those forces, how do we hang together? Well, let's look at today. There's political forces seeking to divide us. There's gerrymandering that does it. There's the internet. Social media has algorithms designed to pull us apart rather than connect us. You know, so the cable TV news is often based on enraging us rather than connecting us. And so with all of these forces that are trying to divide us, we end up now with a society that's deeply divided, very polarized. So we all, for the 250th of this sentence and of this document, should say to ourselves, with all these forces pulling us apart, what can we do to hang together? Because that's the existential question of the nation. Because as Franklin said, if we don't all hang together, we'll all hang separately.
This book is amazing, and I so enjoyed it. I especially enjoyed it because it brought me to revisit and reread your biography of Benjamin Franklin, which is just one of the great biographies, historical biographies of our time.
Thank you so much.
An amazing.
I love Ben Franklin, and that's the reason, in some ways, I did this book, which is, you know, Ben Franklin, so cool. Let's be like Ben Franklin.
Yeah, it's just such an amazing book about such an amazing man. The name of this book is The Greatest Sentence Ever Written. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Walter Isaacson, it is always a great pleasure and honor to speak to you. I thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, it's always a joy to be talking to you. Thanks for having me back.
Thank you so much. Be well. Walter Isaacson is the author of biographies of Benjamin Franklin, Henry Kissinger, Albert Einstein, Steve Jobs, Leonardo da Vinci, and Elon Musk, among others. He has been the editor of Time magazine, the CEO of CNN, and the CEO of the Aspen Institute. His new book, The Greatest Sentence Ever Written, it is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.